What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
We are rolling along here on AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. I'm Larry Rifkin, and with me, always with me, couldn't do it without him, John Krofcik. Yeah. John, you're becoming a fan favorite.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, my college roommate came in the other day, and he's become a big fan of the podcast, and we're glad to have him out there. Hey, Chuck.
Chuck. And I'll have to meet you the next time.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll give you an autograph.
And he came by because he's originally from this area, and he stopped in and he said, "Hey, I want to meet that guy, John. He seems like an interesting guy."
Well, that's nice.
Are you developing a following?
I guess so.
Are you becoming bigger? Am I going to have to negotiate
like
your contract again?
We're like the Abbott and Costello of podcasting.
Yes, we are. Well, who's who?
Lou?
I don't know. I was never a big Abbott and Costello fan. I'm going to be honest with you.
All right.
Who's Laurel on first? I really love the Three Stooges.
The Stooges. Yeah, yeah, there's three of them. Wise guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the Stooges were good.
No, I did love them. I did like Simon and Garfunkel. Oh, no, they weren't comedians. I don't know, but I was not a big fan of Abbott and Costello.
Well, there's Dean and...
And Jerry Lewis! Oh, yeah, they were a lovely couple, weren't they, for all the time that they spent together. Of course, we just lost Jerry Lewis. Who were some of the other great comedy teams? Rowan and Martin.
Right.
The Laugh-In. I grew up with Laugh-In.
Right, that was good.
Though I can't say that I would have paid to see them. I did like
Laurel
the Smothers Brothers.
Laurel
and Hardy. Yes, absolutely.
Another fine mess you got me.
Absolutely.
Into.
My favorite probably was Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, though they never performed together. But boy, they have had an influence on comedy, have they not?
So here we go on podcast.
What?
Larry and
yeah.
John.
Larry and John. I don't know that we're ever going to be singled out in that way. But having said that, we're having fun as an odd couple here on the podcast. I used to love the Odd Couple. In fact,
yes.
You know, my first job ever, John, was as an usher at a theater. Remember ushers?
Yes, usher. I do remember that.
We used to dress up in these uniforms, and they looked very official, and we'd go around with flashlights and tell this guy, "Stop kissing that girl. Wait a minute, that's my girlfriend. What is she doing up there with
you?
You
catch people like me trying to sneak in."
Yeah, absolutely. So I was 16 years of age, and it was a great summer for movies. I got to see The Odd Couple about 400 times, and I'll never forget that. I loved Walter Matthau, and I loved Jack Lemmon.
Yeah,
I mean, two incredible actors. In fact, Jack Lemmon, probably my favorite. But when he'd say, that's not spaghetti, that's linguine. And Walter Matthau, deadpans, now it's garbage. And, of course, we're talking about Neil Simon.
Right.
And there were other great movies that year. Don't let me forget that.
No, that was a good movie.
But I will tell you that Neil Simon and his brother were great comedy writers back in New York, and I believe they came from Brooklyn. Who didn't come from Brooklyn?
Brooklyn. Yeah.
Come on. Everybody came from Brooklyn. I mean, Brooklyn put out so much incredible talent over the years. And I will never forget the story. I did a concert years ago for PBS with Carole King. And Carole King came from Brooklyn, many others.
Yeah,
I mean, star upon star, great singers and comedians. I mean, the talent in Brooklyn was absolutely
amazing.
What
was it in Brooklyn there? Was it the water?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what it was. Well, I think it was that a lot of immigrants who really had high hopes and had aspirations, and they were really determined to make it in America, and they found what their niche was. and then they went for it. And of course, you had Nathan's, and you had Coney Island, and you had Ebbets Field, and it was such a vibrant place.
Wow.
And I always like to think that the place that you and I occupy was something like a little Brooklyn in Connecticut in many ways, because of the diversity of the cultures and the mixing and how that added so much dimension to the quality of our lives. I like to think that.
Yeah, that is. That sounds like a nice place to be.
Yeah, it was really growing up where we grew up was like a miniature Brooklyn. But I want to go back to this story about Carole King, because every year Brooklyn would invite some of those who became so illustrious and had risen from the ranks in Brooklyn. And Carole could be a woman of her own mind, let's say that. And so I believe they invited Carole one year to be the celebrity that they wanted honored in Brooklyn for all that she achieved, which has been remarkable. And from what I recall about this story, she said no that year. And maybe she has subsequently gone back to Brooklyn when they have asked her. But Curtis Mayfield then was the next choice. And Curtis Mayfield, just a remarkable man. In fact, we talked to his son recently about a book that he wrote about his dad. And, of course, they're using some of his music for the Superfly era in this HBO series now written by David Simon of The Wire called Deuce. And he's a remarkable artist. So he agreed to come back and be honored. And that was when the scaffolding fell on him while he was performing.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and then he became, I believe, a quadriplegic. Oh. So, very sad story. But the fact is that Brooklyn has produced so much talent. And Brooklyn itself really fell on hard times. And we know that. I think the stories of Brooklyn's demise or decline were a bit over-exaggerated, because we are now learning that Brooklyn is well on its way to a full recovery.
Yes.
I mean, it's remarkable. Yep. It really is. And my son, when he first decided that he wanted to go into advertising in New York City, and where did we drop him off? Right after he graduated college.
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. There he was. And now when you look at the places in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg and other locations, you can't even afford to go back to Brooklyn.
Wow.
It's gentrified in such a way. And so many people have different definitions of gentrification and whether it's good or it's bad or the displacement and so forth. And we certainly don't shy away from that in this episode of America Trends podcast. We talked to Kay Heimowitz, and she is a scholar at the Manhattan Institute. But for this book, more importantly, she is a resident of Brooklyn, and she has documented with a lot of nuance all the changes in the neighborhoods of Brooklyn. Yeah. Really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I got to hear this podcast.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that fascinates people is that we can all imagine ourselves coming off the boat at Ellis Island and then imagining that we find our way to Brooklyn. And there have been so many movies and so many stories.
They just had a big movie, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn itself,
about
that immigrant, that young woman.
Exactly.
Yeah, a wonderful movie, by the way. But Brooklyn fascinates all of us. And there are so many comedians who would often talk about their growing up in Brooklyn, and so many singers, and then the Brooklyn Bridge itself, Johnny Maestro.
Yep.
And, of course, there's that romanticism of Ebbets Field and what that meant to the city of New York overall. And so let's get into it with Kay Heimowitz, because I think we're a little bit behind in some of the ways that we have imagined Brooklyn, either the romanticized past or that period when it was kind of down and out and was just a stepchild to Manhattan. Well, it's taking on a whole different cast today in 21st century America. Let's learn about it from Kay Heimowitz.
Let's do that.
With us is Kay Heimowitz, and she has written a new book called The New Brooklyn, and it's a wonderful book looking at the various neighborhoods and all the changes that have gone on in Brooklyn. And for you, Kay, this is a very personal matter because you live in Brooklyn and have since the 80s.
That's right. I got interested in writing The New Brooklyn because I had moved into the old Brooklyn, not knowing that there was such a thing at the time, in 1982 into an area called Park Slope, which was mostly white working class. There were some, for lack of a better word, kind of hippies coming in. They were kind of the urban version of Back to the Land. You know, they wanted to set up their own co-ops. There's a very famous cooperative supermarket in Park Slope that I think one of the oldest in the country that was formed at that time. And there were people like that. And then some younger professionals, college-educated people who, for various reasons, wanted to try their hand out at renovating an old building or living in the city. And I was part of a coming wave, I didn't realize it, of course, into a very new thing we now call gentrification.
Take us back before perhaps even you came on the scene in Brooklyn. What had happened to Brooklyn? I mean, it is part of something that has been called capitalistic destruction and reinvention, and you talk about that. How many incarnations has Brooklyn gone through?
Oh, very many, if we want to go way back. I mean, before it was settled, of course, there were the Lenape Indians there. And then the Dutch came, and then the English took over, and, you know, we could go way back there. I think for our purposes, for understanding gentrification and some of the trends that are going on in a lot of, not just American cities, but cities in Europe and other developed countries, there was a rise in an industrial economy that took place really starting in the early 19th century. One big turning point for Brooklyn and for New York City more generally was the building of the Erie Canal, even though that's, 90 miles away. It opened up all sorts of trade possibilities coming from the Midwest and actually going to the Midwest so that, you know, people would send their goods to New York City. It would be a stopping point, and then they would go up into the canal and out the other side into the Midwest. That was a huge turning point for Brooklyn, for New York City, and from then on it just became much more and more of an industrial success. People put their warehouses there, merchants would build their warehouses, and then we got a whole crew of inventors, of entrepreneurs who came in and figured out what to do with some of those goods. One of the most famous was a coffee importer who had some fancy way of roasting the beans and keeping them safe for a longer period of time. He became a huge success and was known as the Coffee King for a very long time. His name was John Arbuckle. And then we had sugar refineries, and we could go on and on, all kinds of very successful factories, most of them founded by immigrants. Brooklyn was, and this was true of New York City more generally, was very much an immigrant city. Of course, it was at that time it was mostly European immigrants, though not only. And those immigrants came in very large waves, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century. And our history has really been marked by those waves of immigration and the impact it had on the industrial economy, or rather, I should put it differently, the industrialization actually lured in a lot of those immigrants because there were jobs. And there was a lack of people to take those jobs.
Why is it that when I think about Brooklyn, well, my dad was born there and enjoyed life there as a young person, but there's a certain romanticism. A lot of artists came out. I'm talking about musical artists from Carole King to Curtis Mayfield and many others. I mean, what is it about Brooklyn, and how would you look at it compared to, say, Queens or the Bronx? I mean, what is the status that Brooklyn has had?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I'm not sure that I can explain why we got so many of these artists who grew up in Brooklyn and various poor neighborhoods throughout Brooklyn in the from the 20s or maybe even earlier on. The Marx Brothers, for instance, came out of. I believe they came out of Brownsville, which was an extremely poor Jewish ghetto at the time. And, You know, some of it, I think, was the Jewish influence on the comedians, the Borscht Belt influence of a certain kind of humor that once it took hold in American culture, it reached into the mainstream by the you know, 40s, 50s, and that kind of thing. So I think partly it was something about the immigrant ghetto life that was very rich and nourishing to entrepreneurial, and I mean that in the broadest sense, activity. So young people who had artistic gifts had opportunities that maybe they couldn't possibly have had in the old country, and they blossomed.
When we look at Brooklyn and the way that you dissect this story of the New Brooklyn, it is many stories, and you have to understand how different they are, and you've been very nuanced in this book, Park Slope, Williamsburg, Bed-Stuy, Brownsville, so on. Do people really take the time to look at the changes and the evolution of the New Brooklyn and really look at how each of these areas has developed?
Oh, I think not, and thank you for noticing that in the book. One of the things I wanted to do in this book was to use gentrification as just one piece of the story of Brooklyn, because the media has become so obsessed with the cool Brooklyn, right? The Brooklyn that everybody wants, every young college graduate wants to move to, the place where it's a little gritty.
That's where my son started, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a little gritty still, so you feel kind of cool, and at the same time, it's got all the amenities. You can get the great coffee and great food and great music and so on and so forth. And also, that's where good very cool jobs are. Shouldn't leave that out, because that was a big issue in bringing the gentrifiers here. But there were other things going on elsewhere. I point out in the book, gentrification really started in the 80s, or possibly even a little bit earlier. It depends how you really want to define it. But maybe I choose the 80s because that's when I got there. I figure I was an early gentrifier. But it wasn't until the later 90s that Williamsburg, which is the hipster paradise, or became the hipster paradise for a while, became that. I mean, it was really just a down and out, decaying working class neighborhood where all the jobs had left, and the piers were emptied and rusty and rotting into the East River, and it was the kind of place where the mob might leave a dead body or two. You know, it wasn't a place that people were looking to live. But young people discovered it, young artists, because it had all these large warehouses and factories and wonderful spaces for them. But that, again, is just one story. I became very interested in places like Brownsville, which is one of the poorest areas of New York, of the entire city, not just Brooklyn, almost entirely black. That has not changed at all. It's still very, very depressed. The great Robert Moses, and I say that with with a little bit of a grin, built a lot of housing projects there, and those housing projects are not in good shape, and people plant themselves in there for generations. And at this point, of course, there's no place for them to go because things have gotten so expensive. But it's really languished, that area, and the people in Brownsville have not done well. The schools continue to suffer. And the crime is down all over the city. It is still one of the most dangerous areas of the city. Then I also got interested in the immigrant areas, because we forget, most people forget when they're just reading the glossy magazines about weekends in Brooklyn, that Brooklyn is 37% foreign-born. And a lot of those immigrants, most of them are quite poor, and they come and they form small enclaves where they kind of tend to each other and find jobs through, various networks and open up stores to appeal to each other. And that is still very much a Brooklyn story.
why has gentrification, as you see it, gotten a bad name? You said it's as hated as it is misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's for perfectly understandable reasons, and I try to do my best in the book to give, like you say, a nuanced picture of this. Gentrification has, I think, both saved the city but made it a much harder place for some people to live. It has gentrification has given us much safer streets, much more amenities, has given us new, you know, hundreds, thousands probably of new businesses. As young people, you know, a talented group of young people come in and open up new businesses and hire people, and so the jobs have increased. So gentrification is associated with all that, but of course it's also associated with much higher housing costs and changing neighborhoods. So at the same time that some people are benefiting from gentrification by coming here and finding a great life for themselves and living, they may be living in small apartments, but they have the amenities they want, they have the peers they want. Other people are finding it impossible to hang on. We are a city of renters, and landlords get hold of, or get news of a friend down the street who sold their building or bought a building and somehow got rid of some of their tenants and renovated and then rented at luxury prices. And that's happening a lot. So there's some nefarious things going on for many people. There's been a lot of concern about the racial impact of these changes. Some people see gentrification as by definition racist because our inequality or our poor people tend to be or more likely to be people of color. So if people move into an area like Bed-Stuy, which for many decades was a black neighborhood, if you get whites moving in there, it's seen as devastating to the local culture. Not to mention to the housing stock, which becomes ever more expensive.
Well, there was a notion of the stoop culture years ago, everybody hanging out on the stoop of these brownstones and the like. And yet, I think you're pointing out in Bed-Stuy, for example, it may not be as much racial as it is class involved. So those who are middle class or upper middle class and professional blacks and whites coming together around this new life in Bed-Stuy.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is something that people leave out of this gentrification story if they see it as just a race story. There are many black gentrifiers, and a lot of them choose to, meaning young black professionals, people who've been to college and want to move back to the city and want the same things that white college grads want. They want good coffee. I remember interviewing a young woman who had opened a coffee shop in Bed-Stuy, one of the first $3 cups of coffee you could get at that time. And she was black, and she said, "I lived on coffee in college, and I needed good coffee." And another black shop owner told me, my friend and I were looking for, a place to sip wine. So he opened up a wine bar. There are a number of stories like that in Bed-Stuy. And a lot of the new homeowners are black, or mixed marriages in many cases as well. And also, Bed-Stuy has seen an increase in the number of Hispanic residents as well. That's something people tend to ignore in the black-white story, because our Hispanic population has increased quite a bit also.
Well, you're right. They're making a mistake when some people are opposed to the coming of the white middle class. The difficult truth, and it is immensely difficult, is that gentrification would be about the best thing that could ever happen to Brownsville. Now, Brownsville seems to be left out of the better picture that is being developed. So is this really the enclave or the, you know, refuge for people who want to go to someplace in Brooklyn but have nowhere else to go because they've been priced out of the remainder of Brooklyn?
Well, remember, Brooklyn's very large. Brownsville happens to be fairly well located in relation to the subway stops, and that's everything in New York City. If you can be near a subway stop, you can live pretty far away from Manhattan, because that's your key to your transportation to work in most cases. So Brownsville has that, and that's why people are looking at it and wondering about gentrification coming to that neighborhood. The reason that I'm a little skeptical is because of the housing projects I mentioned earlier. Brownsville has the largest concentration of housing projects of any place in the country. They are old and aging and somewhat decrepit, and they're not well tended, and there is a lot of crime there. And what those housing projects mean also is that there's not a lot of decent housing to be had in Brownsville. There's some, and that could happen. You could see gentrification in those small areas where there are smaller family homes. But again, I hesitate to make any predictions because I've been wrong.
Well, why does one area, say, of Brooklyn come back and another doesn't? Is it about the good bones in terms of the architecture? Is it about proximity to Manhattan? Is it about the subway stops? What is it that has all of these folks rushing forward to get into Williamsburg or to Park Slope and so forth and Bed-Stuy and not so much Brownsville?
Yeah, well, all of the above. It is the housing stock. I think people are drawn, as the great Jane Jacobs understood many decades ago in The Death and Life of Great Cities, people are drawn to these sort of small town feeling, these village-like center areas where they can shop and see neighbors and know the shopkeepers and that kind of thing. And Brooklyn was a city of neighborhoods. It was smaller scale. It was lower. Pete Hamill refers to it as horizontal as opposed to Manhattan, which was vertical. By the way, this is changing as we speak. And so I think Brooklyn had that appeal. It felt like a livable place in terms of the scale of the building, the scale of the architecture, the feeling of the street life. And the brownstone areas were particularly nice in that way. And, you know, Bed-Stuy, I mentioned before, which always had a fairly dark reputation as a dangerous area, at least when I first moved in, and it was, relatively speaking, has some of the most beautiful brownstones in all of Brooklyn and all of New York City. Eventually they were going to be bought up by people who would take an interest both in the architecture, who had the money to do something, you know, to renovate those buildings, and wanted to be a quick subway ride away from Wall Street or Midtown, and they would be. But Brownsville is just a few stops past there, but again, the housing stock is such that I don't know that people are going to want to go there. But we will see. I said before, it's hard to make predictions. I never in a million years, though I've benefited from it enormously, would have predicted what would happen to Park Slope when we moved there.
Let's talk about Brooklyn Navy Yard and the waterfront. And called Dock 72, there's a 16-story tall structure stretching across it. I know that Samuel Rudin, now a late patriarch of the real estate dynasty, built a lot of the family's portfolio with a rule that if a property wasn't accessible by subway, he wasn't interested. But his heirs now are saying as long as a ferry boat is available, then they want to develop it. And there's been a 36% 20% increase from 2016 in terms of office leasing in Brooklyn. Is this another part of the evolution that's going on?
Yeah. Again, I'm a little bit skeptical about the role that ferries can play in the continuing gentrification of Brooklyn for this reason. The ferries, although on the Brooklyn side, they could leave you fairly close to home if you live in North Brooklyn, if you live in Williamsburg, or if you live in Fort Greene, or if you live in downtown Brooklyn. They will not take you to Midtown, or rather, they take you to Midtown, but they leave you pretty, you know, totally to the east, which means that you then have to get on a bus to go cross town. And if you've ever been on a cross town Manhattan bus, you'll know that that's not something to look forward to it at 8:30 in the morning. So if you're going to work, so that's why I'm just a little bit skeptical. It's a limited population that's going to be working close enough to the East River to make that viable.
In terms of the process of revitalization of this area of Brooklyn, I mean, tell us where we are in the process. I mean, is it still accelerating? Has it reached its peak? Do you see signs where you can see so much more going on? What are you seeing right now?
Yeah. Well, I referred earlier to the fact that we're becoming a much more vertical city, Brooklyn is. We now have some very tall buildings, and now in downtown Brooklyn, it's completely unrecognizable. It is a forest of skyscrapers, and there's talk about building one of these super tall buildings. And I won't be able to tell you how many stories that means.
By the way, what is considered downtown Brooklyn? Is that where the Barclays Center has been built?
Well, yes. Some people would call it Barclays Center, then to the water, to the East River.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably put it closer into a little bit closer towards the East River, on Flatbush, if you're staying on Flatbush from Barclays. But yes, because of the Barclays Center and various buildings that are going up along Flatbush, I think that is all now coming under the same rubric of downtown Brooklyn. It used to be just a part of Flatbush. But that whole area is super, you know, quite tall skyscrapers, and it's really not, it really has completely changed the character of that part of Brooklyn. That is also part of what some people call the tech triangle. We had a lot of young tech companies moving into the area known as Dumbo, which it means down under the Manhattan Bridge Dumbo, and has become one of the most expensive areas, one of the expensive neighborhoods in the entire city of New York. And it's right underneath those bridges. It's terribly noisy from the cars and subways going across those bridges. But it's filled with atmosphere and charm from the old factories and warehouses that I talked about earlier. And so that's right next to downtown Brooklyn. They kind of merge together at a certain point.
What is it that you have to have, and what is it that Brooklyn represents when we're thinking about other parts of the country and this whole issue of gentrification is rising everywhere? I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal, the Cincinnati neighborhood transforms. Still rising property values have driven dozens of families out of neighborhoods, and longtime residents are upset because mom and pop shops and laundromats and neighborhood grocery stores have gone away. They're very concerned about the changes. And yet you say we have to understand, ultimately, that there are going to be in gentrification mode winners and losers. But when we have decline, everybody loses. So how do we play these trade-offs?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. It's something I struggle with all the time because there are a lot of losses that come with change, and a change like gentrification, because it's happening very quickly, is quite upsetting to a lot of us. There's not a person in New York City that isn't doesn't get a lump in their throat at some point looking at a certain shop or restaurant that's closing that they had long, you know, remember going to when they were first married or something like that. That happens all the time. So I can't come. I'm not sure that I can give you a formula. I think that the problem for Brooklyn has been that it has happened so very quickly, and you look around and you and there needs to be some kind of continuity, some sense that yesterday is not going to be so enormously different from today and tomorrow. There has to be some stability, some sense of rootedness. And I think at times with the current stage of gentrification, the current, what some people refer to as hyper-gentrification, we can lose that sense of having a thread to the past. But to answer your question that you posed earlier about where does it go from here, I think that a lot of people are going to be put off by the rising prices. I know personally family members who young people who are dying to stay in New York have jobs here, good jobs, and can't afford to raise a family here, in even in Brooklyn. So they're going to move. They're going to go. The suburbs are now beginning to grow again. That's something we're hearing about. The prices.
Really, you've got to tell us that here in Connecticut.
Oh well, I can't. Yeah, I gather you're having your own.
We're having our own difficulty. I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, is it technology in terms of people coming in to take these tech jobs? Is it the fact that young people find New York in general so enviable as a place to live? Is it the access to the water, the access to Manhattan? I mean, is what Brooklyn has done so special that we shouldn't look upon it as being an example to other communities around the country?
Well, I think they're probably some things to learn from it, but some things that are sui generis. And as I mentioned at the end of my book, one of the things that Brooklyn benefited from, you're not going to find elsewhere, and that was its proximity to New York City, which was the financial center of the country. People, which meant that you had money already in the city. You had a history of media centering themselves in New York City, and you also had art, cultural institutions as well. So all of that created a kind of allure for a lot of people who wanted, you know, were interested in those things. And as the media grew and changed, and I say that knowing that the newspaper business is in terrible shape, but in general there are many more outlets for young people interested in media to be in. I'm always amazed at the number of young people I meet who are documentary filmmakers.
Well, I don't know if they can afford. They're often starving, unless their name is Ken Burns. Well, Kay, I want to thank you so much for coming by today on America Trends Podcast, because this is truly a trend. And in closing, is there one thing about this revival of this borough that you love? Is there one thing that has even, you know, shocked you?
Well, I think I would go back to two things. I'll mention two things. One is the downtown area, which now is, like I said, it is completely unrecognizable. It doesn't look like Brooklyn. It is now a vertical city, and it is, and that, I think, you could say, it's no longer got its character, and it's bittersweet. It's nice to know so many people who want to move to Brooklyn can now, and it's at the same time, it's not the Brooklyn I remember. And then also, I would say the changes in Bed-Stuy. Bed-Stuy was one of the most dangerous areas in New York City. It is becoming very highly sought after, and I think it's doing very well for a lot of its long-term inhabitants, not everybody, but for a lot.
maybe the Dodgers are coming back.
Maybe the Dodgers will come back. One can always hope.
Kay Heimowitz, I thank you so much. Wonderful book and great insights. The New Brooklyn, What It Takes to Bring a City Back. Thank you for coming by today.
Thank you. Well, okay. Larry, that was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some ranking, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
No spamming, nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us. But.
Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, at Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did
yeah,
you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that,
yeah,
too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? You know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more, because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste, and you get more programming like this, and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
Absolutely.
For all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. Let us out.
What's that?
They're not going to let us out.
No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.